Part 7. Law and Regulation, EU and USA. Chapter 28. You are the responsible party. Welcome back. In part 6, we talked about the physical product, getting it labeled, packaged, market ready. Now we find out whether it is actually legal to sell. And here's the thing, nobody says clearly enough at the start. The moment you import a product from outside the EU and put it on the European market under your own name, you become the manufacturer in the eyes of the law, not the factory in Shenzhen. You. Product safety, conformity, labeling, liability, all of it lands on your desk. The factory produces, you are responsible. Write that one down if you haven't already. It is the single most important sentence in this entire part. Let's start with labeling, because it is where most people get hurt first. And not because it is complicated, because it looks simple. A symbol printed, a warning translated, a sticker added. How hard can it be? Harder than it looks. Because labeling is not a cosmetic afterthought. It is the visible surface of a regulatory system. Authorities, customs, and marketplaces check it preferentially because it is the fastest thing to verify. An incorrectly rendered CE mark, a missing symbol below the WEEE bin, incomplete importer details. Any one of those is enough to stop a product even if it works perfectly. Two systems sit on top of each other in EU imports. First, product-specific markings. CE under the applicable harmonization directives, WEEE for electrical and electronic equipment. The 0-3 symbol for toys, GHS pictograms for chemicals. And second, the general requirements from the GPSR, the General Product Safety Regulation that came into force in December 2024. The GPSR is not optional. It is not a nice to have that arrived and can be ignored for a while. Marketplaces now automatically check listings against GPSR requirements. If you are not compliant, the listing loses visibility. Without any prior inquiry, no warning, no discussion, just gone. So what does GPSR actually require? At its core, manufacturer and importer details, a contact address and a unique identifier, batch number, serial number, something that makes the product traceable, must be on the product itself, permanently, legibly, not on a loose insert, not on the cardboard box that gets thrown away, on the product. And if you want to move that information to the packaging because the product is too small, you need a genuine technical reason, not a design preference, not the logo looks cleaner without the address, an actual physical impossibility.
There's also an EU responsible person requirement. Whenever the manufacturer is outside the European Union, which in import means almost always, there must be a named contact inside the EU that authorities can actually reach. This is not a name on paper. It is a real operational role. Someone who can produce your technical documentation on short notice. Someone with a phone that gets answered. A service provider with 200 mandates and no time for your specific product when an authority calls is not protection. It is a billing line with a compliance-shaped gap. Then there is the CE marking itself. CE is not a general Europe logo. It is a legally binding conformity marking for products that fall under specific EU harmonization legislation. For products that do not fall under those directives, the CE mark is not optional. It is prohibited. Putting it on a product where it has no place is not a minor branding decision. It is a formal violation. And the most important structural point, CE is a self-declaration. Nobody stamps it on your product after inspecting it. You declare that the product meets all relevant requirements. You sign the EU Declaration of Conformity, the DOC. And by signing it, you take on full legal responsibility for everything it claims. That declaration is based on a technical file, a system of product descriptions, risk assessments, test reports, and harmonized standards. If the file does not exist or does not hold together under scrutiny, the CE mark on the product is legally worthless. It looks fine, it proves nothing. CE also applies to the exact product that was tested, not the product family, not a similar version, the precise configuration, same components, same materials, same firmware. The moment the factory switches a battery cell because it got a cent cheaper or changes a coating to save lead time, the previous test report may no longer apply. Same box, same logo, different product, regulatorily. And nobody sends you a memo about that. The book goes deep into the technical machinery here. The full technical file structure, how harmonized standards work, which directives apply to which product categories, the notified body system for higher risk products. In this overview, hold the principles. CE is a system, not a sticker. The DOC is your declaration, not the factory's. And documentation that does not hold together falls apart at the first real checkpoint, which is usually customs, a marketplace suspension, or market surveillance, buying your product anonymously and testing it in a state lab. In that order, each one faster than you'd like.
Chapter 29. The United States, a liability-driven system. Moving from the European Union to the United States is not a geographic step. It is a system change. In the EU, conformity is established before market entry. CE, REACH, GPSR, the gates are at the front. In the USA, the gates are different. Requirements exist, significant ones, but enforcement is not primarily a pre-market approval system. It happens after, through market mechanisms, through regulatory agencies, and through courts. In the USA, compliance does not mainly protect you from a visit by regulators. It protects you against the plaintiff's attorney. That is the mental switch you need to make before you ship your first product to an American address. The foundation of the US system is product liability, and the most important concept is strict liability. Strict liability means that negligence does not need to be proven. It is sufficient that a product is classified as defective, that harm has occurred, and that you were part of the distribution chain. Being in the chain means bearing liability. Whether you were careful or not is essentially irrelevant. Three types of defect matter. Design defect. The product is unsafe by its very construction, even when built correctly. Manufacturing defect. The design was sound, but something went wrong in production. And failure to warn. The product worked fine, but the risks were not adequately communicated. In the USA, failure to warn is not a footnote. It is its own independent ground for liability. A product that works perfectly but carries risks the customer was not told about can still generate a claim. And when individual cases combine, that is a class action. Small individual damages that would not be worth pursuing alone reach a financially significant scale when pooled. A law firm specializing in exactly this plays the instrument with practiced ease. Class actions are also publicly visible, media covered. That pressure generates further claims. The moment one catches momentum, the numbers move fast. Now, the regulatory actors. Three agencies cover the import landscape. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, governs food, cosmetics, dietary supplements, and medical products. Every cosmetics importer needs to understand MOCRA, the Modernization of Cosmetics Regulation Act, now fully in force. Facility registration, product listing, safety substantiation, adverse event reporting. These are now requirements, not suggestions. The FCC, Federal Communications Commission, governs every device that transmits or receives radio frequencies, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cellular, wireless remotes, baby monitors. Every active transmitter needs a formal FCC ID before it ships. Selling a radio-capable product in the US without an FCC ID is not an administrative oversight. It is a federal offense. The fines the FCC imposes routinely exceed the cost of proper certification by a wide margin. That is the expensive way to learn the process. And the third agency, which covers the widest ground, the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. That is the next chapter. One more thing before we get there. Insurance. In the US market, product liability insurance is not a nice to have. It is part of the business model. Without a US legal entity, there is no corporate shield between a product defect and your personal assets. US courts are comfortable asserting jurisdiction as soon as someone actively serves the US market. The Atlantic Ocean does not function as a legal firewall. A policy with at least $1 million of coverage per occurrence is the baseline. And Amazon makes it mandatory in writing once monthly sales cross $10,000. Which means, sort it before that moment, not in the 30-day scramble afterward.
The EU and the USA are not two versions of the same system. They are two different philosophies about where risk gets managed, before the product enters the market or after it causes harm. The importer sits at the center of both. The book lays out the full operational detail for each agency. Here, the principle is what matters. Know which system you are operating in and plan for both its demands accordingly.
Chapter 30. The CPSC, CPSIA, and the Children's Product Trap. The CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, has jurisdiction over an enormous range of consumer goods. Household products, furniture, recreational equipment, anything that does not fall squarely under the FDA or the FCC. But one category it pursues with particular intensity, products for children. The CPSIA, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, layers significantly heightened requirements on top of the base CPSC framework for any product intended for children under 12. And here is the first trap. The CPSC decides whether something is a children's product, not you. The agency evaluates advertising claims, packaging design, distribution channel, and physical characteristics. A laser pointer with a housing shaped like a colorful fish is a toy in the CPSC's view, regardless of how you categorized it internally. The product must then meet toy standard ASTMF 963, with all the testing that entails. The factory's categorization is not the one that matters at the US port. The certification system splits in two. General-use consumer goods need a General Certificate of Conformity, a GCC. It can be based on the manufacturer's reasonable testing program. For children's products, the requirements are harder. A children's product certificate, a CPC, is required, and it can only be issued based on testing by a CPSC-accredited third-party laboratory. And here's the detail people miss. Accreditation is not global. It applies to a specific laboratory location and a specific test method. A major institute with labs in Shenzhen, Hamburg, and Hong Kong is not interchangeable across those locations. The CPSC lab ID on the report must belong to exactly the location where the sample was actually tested. A technically clean report from the wrong location is a formally invalid CPC. The chemical limits that matter most, lead at 100 parts per million for substrate materials and 90 parts per million for surface coatings, measured per individual component, not averaged across the product. Every zipper, every snap, every painted surface. 8 specific phthalates prohibited above 0.1% in accessible components of toys and infant articles. Flammability requirements under 16 CFR 1610 for textiles. Missing a flammability test is one of the most common reasons CPCs get rejected. It is not exotic. It is one of the standard checks that gets skipped in the rush.
Every children's product also needs a tracking label on the product and on the packaging. Manufacturer name, place of production, date of production, batch or run number, permanently attached. Not a sticker that peels off at first handling. The purpose of this label is the ability to isolate one batch in a recall without pulling everything you have ever sold. Without it, the CPSC's option is a total recall of your entire product history. The gap between those two outcomes is often 6 figures. From 2025 and 2026 onward, e-filing of conformity data through the US Customs System, the ACE system, became mandatory for many product categories. The certificate data travels digitally before the goods arrive. An algorithm cross-checks it in real time. Does the lab ID match the test standard? Is the batch number plausible? Are there existing warnings against this manufacturer? Discrepancies automatically flag a physical inspection. Getting through customs on incomplete documentation is now technologically much harder than it used to be. And one more mechanism worth knowing. Section 15B of the CPSA, the reporting obligation. If you learn that a product you sell may have a defect that could pose a substantial hazard, you must notify the CPSC. Within 24 hours of learning there is an issue, in practice. And the threshold is not someone got seriously hurt. It is information that reasonably supports the conclusion that a risk could exist. Customer service emails about unusual heat buildup, a pattern of returns with the same complaint. If a reasonable person would infer a potential hazard from that pattern, the clock is already running. When in doubt, the CPSC's own guidance is simple.
report. The book walks through the operational detail here thoroughly. The full e-filing process, the specific chemical standards, how to verify lab accreditation before you commission the test. In this overview, the essentials. Know whether your product is a children's product by USA standards before you source it. Commission testing at an accredited lab with the correct lab ID for each applicable standard. Build the tracking label into the production tooling, not onto a sticker. And have the certificate data ready to file before the container sails.
Chapter 31. Operational Risk Management, Recalls, Documentation and Insurance. Risk Management.
The phrase sounds like a department in a large company with a corner office and a complicated dashboard. In the import business, it is simpler than that, and more important. It is a structured process through which you record what hazards a product can generate, how likely they are to occur, and how bad the consequences would be. Then you take measures to bring the risk to an acceptable level. The EU framework under GPSR and ISO 12100, and the US framework under ISO 14971, and the QMSR for medical devices both follow the same logic. Identify hazards, assess them, reduce them, verify that the reduction worked, then document all of it. The documentation is not bureaucracy. It is your legal defense. In a crisis, a recall, a regulatory inquiry, a liability claim, the quality of your risk analysis decides whether you demonstrate due diligence or face gross negligence. Those are not two shades of the same outcome. One is a recoverable situation, the other is a different category entirely. Risk reduction follows a hierarchy that courts take seriously. Step 1. Eliminate the risk through design. If a battery can catch fire when overcharged, the first answer is a protection circuit that physically interrupts current flow. Step 2. If the hazard cannot be designed out, install a technical safeguard, a housing that prevents access to live parts, a mechanical barrier. Step 3, and this one matters, warning labels in the manual are the weakest form of risk reduction. A sticker saying hot surface, do not touch, is legally effective only if the surface could not technically have been made cooler. Warnings do not substitute for a safe design. Courts know this. Plaintiffs' attorneys know this. Now you know it too. Traceability, batch numbers, serial numbers, a clean link between production records and customer orders is not just a documentation preference. It is the difference between a targeted recall and a total recall. A targeted recall is expensive and operationally demanding. A total recall, every unit of everything you have ever sold, is a different category of problem. The gap between the two is often entirely explained by whether someone can look up which batch went to which customer. That lookup takes seconds when the system is built. It is impossible when it is not.
Insurance. In the USA, product liability insurance is not optional. It is the last line of defense when the first three lines, product design, compliance documentation, and traceability, have already been tested. Insurers know this. They now examine carefully who they are underwriting. Missing documentation, opaque supply chains, incomplete testing, these reliably produce exclusions or premiums that reflect the actual risk profile. A $1 million policy for a low-risk product category costs $500 to $1,500 a year. That is less than a single hour with a US attorney, which is a comparison worth keeping in mind. On labs, not every test report is created equal. In China, CNAS accreditation is the quality indicator. China's official accreditation body, a signatory to the ILAC mutual recognition arrangement, which means reports are generally recognized in the EU and USA. For US children's products, the CPSC lab ID is additionally required. For regulated EU products, a notified body is often needed. A report without recognized accreditation has, in an emergency, the value of the paper it is printed on. 5 minutes checking the CNAS public register can save five-figure legal fees later. And one more thing about recalls. Not just how to survive one, but how they work publicly. In the USA, recalls are announced. They are on the CPSC website, in the media, searchable for years. Reputational damage is automatic and lasting. The operational demands are significant. Identifying affected units, communicating to customers and retail partners, accepting returns or issuing replacements, full documentation for the authorities. All of this is manageable if the traceability system is built, much less so if it is not.
The book has the full operational detail on the risk management process, the risk matrix structure, how to document the three-step hierarchy for the technical file, and what the CPSC expects in a Section 15B initial report. Here, the principle is the thing to carry forward. Risk management is not a document you file once and forget. It is the system you run in parallel with everything else. The insurance policy you write for yourself by asking uncomfortable questions before anything goes wrong. Chapter 32. California Proposition 65 and the Bounty Hunter Economy. If you ship to the USA, you ship to California. There is no realistic way to exclude it. A product sold nationwide reaches California addresses, and California runs its own program, Proposition 65, formerly the Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act of 1986. Over 900 chemicals on its list, from heavy metals like lead and cadmium to substances found in everyday consumer products. The legal mechanism is not a ban, it is a warning obligation. If you expose any person to a listed chemical at a level above a defined safe threshold without first providing a clear and reasonable warning, you are in violation. The burden is on you to prove you are below the threshold or to put the warning on the product. Here is the part that makes Proposition 65 genuinely different. In the EU, market surveillance is run by state agencies. In California, it has been effectively privatized. Any private individual or organization can file suit on behalf of the public interest. And a specialized enforcement industry has grown up around exactly that. These bounty hunters, that is the actual term used in the industry, are specialized plaintiff groups and law firms that systematically purchase products on Amazon, Walmart, or in local stores, have them tested in their own laboratories, and send a 60-day notice of violation if they find a listed substance without a corresponding warning. Their infrastructure is considerably more professional than the compliance department of many an importer. They do this for a living, every day. The financial logic: the plaintiff retains 25% of civil penalties imposed, up to $2,500 per violation per day, and also has legal fees reimbursed by the defendant if they win. In practice, almost all cases settle out of court for between $20,000 and $50,000, often regardless of whether the product actually posed a hazard. That is not legal proceedings, that is a raid schedule, and it operates efficiently. The chemical limits under Proposition 65 often sit far below the EU thresholds. A REACH-compliant test showing lead below 1,000 parts per million is not protection in California. Proposition 65 may trigger at concentrations of 100 parts per million or below, depending on how much of that substance transfers to the skin under normal use. A toxicological exposure analysis is often required to prove you are below the safe harbor level. That analysis costs several thousand dollars per SKU, more than a standard lab test, which is why the economics of overwarning, putting the Proposition 65 warning label on the product, look attractive. But many major US retailers will not accept products with that warning. They view it as a brand image issue. So the choice is test precisely or carry the label and lose retailer relationships. Neither option is free. If a 60-day notice of violation arrives in your inbox, first, take the affected listing down immediately, across the entire US if possible, not just California, to stop the per-day violation count. Second, commission independent testing of the affected batch. Third, engage legal counsel and begin settlement conversations. In 95% of cases, a quick settlement is the most economically rational path. Legal fees for a US court defense typically exceed the settlement amount within a few weeks. That explains why almost nobody fights, and why almost nobody gets acquitted. One practical example to make this concrete. An importer sources a stainless steel kitchen spatula with a silicone handle. The supplier confirms FDA food grade. A bounty hunter has the handle tested and finds phthalates at 0.15%. In Europe, the product is borderline compliant. In California, without a warning label, that finding triggers a 60-day notice. Result? $32,000 in settlement, destruction of US inventory, and the contractual obligation to perform wet chemical testing on every future batch. The product margin is gone for years. The supplier confirmation meant nothing. One honest note before we close this part. The book goes 33,000 words deep on the legal and regulatory landscape we have just walked through in overview. What you have here are the principles and the mental models, what the systems are and why they work the way they do. For the operational detail, the technical file structure, the full CPSCE filing process, the chemical thresholds table, the FCC certification steps, the Proposition 65 exposure analysis methodology, that level of specificity is in the book, not in this audio. Use this overview to understand what you are dealing with. Use the book when you are actually doing it. And wherever real legal or regulatory decisions are on the line, talk to a qualified professional. This overview is not advice, it is orientation. And with that, the legal and compliance landscape is mapped. The EU, with its gate-at-the-front documentation-driven model. The USA, with its liability-driven enforcement-after-the-fact system. The CPSC and CPSIA for consumer product safety. Risk management as the operating system behind all of it. And California as the reminder that the most restrictive rule in a room quietly sets the standard for everyone in the room. What comes next is packaging. And packaging turns out to be its own regulatory universe. Extended producer responsibility, the EU's Packaging and Packaging Waste Regulation, the PPWR, and what EPR actually means for import businesses operating across borders. Turns out, the box your product comes in is now almost as regulated as the product itself. Almost. See you in Part 8.